All right, it's time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Doing. Can I believe it? I just almost called him Neil Doing.
Don't.
Mr. Ben Howe.
Do that again.
I had a flashback. Ben Howe, ladies and gentlemen. Ben Howe.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Not bad.
All right, and the news gal, Andrea Ruth, is here as well.
I'm here, not from Pakistan today.
Look at that. Uzbekistan.
I think it was, I didn't think it was Pakistan.
Well, I like to think that wherever I am has nuclear weapons. So.
It was, okay. So India or Pakistan. Is that the way it is?
Yep.
Okay, great. All right, so before we get started here, just so you know, if you like this podcast, we appreciate it if you went out to iTunes, give us a rating, give us a review, make it 5 stars. If you don't like it, then just kind of like leave us alone. Otherwise, you know, be nice. Okay, so this week we are happy to welcome, she's a senior writer at Commentary and was my editor when she was the editor at Acculturated. Used to be also a her resume is very long. She's a very distinguished resume. She was managing editor at the Weekly Standard. She's author of 2 books. It's, you know, she said, okay, Jay, I will lower myself to appear on your podcast. I'd be happy to do it. Christine Rosen.
Hi, Jay. I am not lowering myself at all. I expect to feel very elevated in your company and Ben's company.
Well, I'll tell you what, and Andrea probably can back me up on this, because since you're the guest here, you'll get to speak a lot more than you probably do on the Commentary podcast.
This is true. So I feel like, remember Heather Locklear when she was the special guest star on Melrose Place? So I always feel like if I'm the special guest, I get a little more mic time. So,
there you go. And we're only kidding about, you know, Commentary. It's just that, you know, John and Noah and Abe are always in the studio and you're kind of back there. You're here in D.C., so it's kind of like, you know, not being in the room.
I just wanted on record that I don't remember anything about my room's place because.
Don't say you're too young. Don't say you're too young.
No, I'm not too young.
No, he's lying is what he said.
Right. I did not have a girlfriend in the 90s that made me watch all of those shows.
That's a legitimate excuse.
All right. So Christine writes a lot on culture, and she writes a lot about social media, which is ironic considering that she is like not to be found on social media. She doesn't have a Twitter account. If she's got a Facebook account, it's like one of the best kept secrets on the planet. No LinkedIn, none of that stuff. No Instagram. You know, in fact, it was funny. I was emailing Christine about being on the show, and I was searching for a picture of her to use for an avatar on our website. And unfortunately, there was an algorithm that put an image. Who was the person?
It was the radical feminist Andrea Dworkin.
Right. It was a photo from a piece that she had written, but it actually showed Andrea Dworkin, and underneath it said Christine Rosen, writer.
Yeah, it was really unfortunate. I mean, Dworkin could really rock those overalls, you know, but yeah, she and I hope don't look too much alike.
So, I mean,
I'm very jealous though, because I lost a lot of weight over the last few years, and unfortunately, almost all of the photos of me online, and there are many, are me as a giant tub of lard. And so, when anybody finds me online, they just start calling me fat immediately, and then I got to, you know, whimper to them about how I've lost weight. So.
You got to get an Instagram account that shows your weight loss journey. You know, lots of hashtags, wellness, hashtag, you know,
yes.
Best life.
Hashtag best life, blessed.
Blessed, fit over 40, you know, that kind of thing.
That's right. Best shape of my life.
So, Christine, do you mind saying why you don't have a social media account? Is that off limits?
No, not at all. I'm happy to talk about that and to proselytize to others so that they join my weirdo cult. When Facebook first emerged on the scene, and then, you know, Twitter and Instagram and so on and so forth, I just had the decent Amish reaction, although I'm not Amish, which was to say, is this necessary? What are the drawbacks as well as the benefits? And do I need this? Is this something I really need, given what I know about myself and how I react to things? Facebook was an easy no for me, just because I didn't like what it was purporting to do. And I certainly didn't want to look at ads, and the people who I outgrew as my elementary school friends, I didn't really feel I need to be in touch with. And the ones I have stayed in touch with, we stayed in touch via email. It's been fine. I will say I get a little bit of, there's a little bit of herd immunity with Facebook because my sisters are on it. So whenever anything outrageous occurs in our, from our childhood cohort, they always inform me. But same thing with Twitter, though. I felt that it was not going to present my best self if I was on there. And, you know, the thing about, I love to joke around. I love to have immediate, often politically incorrect reactions to news stories. And I do that with my friends all the time. And it's really hilarious and fun. And I don't think it would suit me to do that publicly. So that was another easy no. And I think just given how those, the platforms have all changed pretty dramatically in the last few years, that was the right call for me. But I think more and more people are questioning whether that might be something they need to do in the future too.
That poor Christine Rosen, 84, though.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. So you never even joined. You're not someone that was on and then quit. You just decided not to from the outset.
Right. I've always been the sort of the Bartleby, the Scrivener, like I'd rather not to all of the social media.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like I was one of the early adopters of Twitter, and I was actually one of those ones that was on there when people actually like did status updates, like going to work and I'm at the office and going to get a sandwich. And you know, it, and then 2008, I think, is, you know, when Barack Obama was like the first big name politician to start utilizing Twitter as an outlet to reach voters. And, you know, it was okay. I mean, I have, you know, you can ask Andrea, I've scaled back my use of Twitter. It was like one of those things where there would be a reply and you just simply could not go without replying to that reply. And sometimes it would just wind up getting you in trouble and you just waste unheard of amount of time engaging with people. It's kind of like, Andrea, what is it that Adam Carolla says about when you, you know, it's like cursing at someone when you're on the road, like you're never going to.
Oh,
like,
you're never going to see that person again. Yeah.
Right. And half the people that you interact with on Twitter are anonymous people that you probably never going to see in real life or meet in real life. And it's kind of like, you know, and you sit there and you wonder, it's like, why do I have to like pull my hair out doing all of this? And so it's like,
right,
yeah.
One of my favorite tweets ever was a guy who said, Twitter is great if you have a lot of issues, but you don't want to solve any of them. And, you know, I believe that. But I will say that I am the Lex Luthor to your Superman, because I'm always singing the virtues of social media while at the same time saying it's destroying the world, which I think it is. But, you know, one of my first thoughts when Jay told me you weren't on social media and then I went and read some of your stuff was, maybe you're actually just more talented and hardworking than me, because Twitter, what Twitter does for me, and this could be a chicken and egg thing, is it makes it so I don't always have to write. I can just sort of say what I think. And then that still keeps some elevation in terms, because, you know, the types of careers we all have involve people having an audience of some sort. Mm-hmm. And so it helps me retain an audience even when I can't get around to writing. Like, I was writing a book for a long time and it was hard for me to write any articles, but I would tweet and it would keep me elevated in that sense. And so what I'm suggesting is maybe you're just, you know, better than me.
No, as much as I'd like to embrace that idea. No, and I look, I'm there are clear values in terms of promotion of one's own work and of friends and colleagues and admired folks' work, and that's important. I guess the to go back to the road rage example, you know, these platforms are designed to trigger that button more than they are to trigger the sort of goodwill for all mankind button, right? So it's like a machine. It's like machine gambling and the slot machines that keep you coming back and back and back, and suddenly you've lost track of time, and, you know, the casinos don't have windows, so how would you know if it's daytime or nighttime? These platforms reward that kind of return behavior because you're always looking for that next little dopamine hit. And we know this, right? This is not new. I mean, it was new when Twitter first came out and we thought, oh, wow, why am I obsessively checking this? We know why we do it. It's designed to make us do that. So I guess my feeling is that we have many temptations throughout the day, and our discipline begins to erode as the hours tick by. And, you know, if you notice, like, angry tweet storms that people do tend to happen late at night, you know, when their willpower is at its weakest, or, you know, after they've watched a reality TV show. Like, those two things, there's a Venn diagram, I think, for rage tweet storms at those hours. But it doesn't bring out the best in most of us, is how I would put it. But it's not without some utility.
Well, sorry, yeah, because certainly, you know, your articles will get shared on social media, even if you're not utilizing it.
Right.
So you'll gain audience via social media, even if you're not participating. Because back when I first started writing, I wasn't really on Twitter, and I didn't realize that people were sharing things I was writing. You know, all 10 of them were sharing things I was writing before I was even on it.
Yeah, and I mean, I do go and lurk on Twitter, especially when it comes to following what politicians are saying. And, you know, as we now know, it's been, for a lot of progressive Democrats, it's been a very bad thing for them. I mean, people complain about President Trump's Twitter habit, but, you know, Ilhan Omar and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have just as much of a problem with Twitter, and I think have gotten themselves into some trouble. Not in some case, because they're spewing hatred and vile things and you know, claiming things as fact that are not fact, but also because it's that instant need to react and to kind of have that hot take and make sure that they get out there. And that harms young, inexperienced politicians in the same way that it harms young Instagram influencers. I mean, they make stupid mistakes, but they do it publicly.
Yeah, well, Christine, go back to that. Necessarily isn't necessarily a mistake, so to speak. But you know, he probably didn't think that he was making much of a mistake until the hammer came down on him, particularly on social media. I'm talking about Beto O'Rourke. You wrote a piece called "Beto Hits a Feminist Tripwire," and he's had to like apologize for saying relatively innocuous things. You know, it's like, hey, I'm my wife is at home. She's taking care of the kids. I help as much as I can, you know, and he had to apologize for that.
No, this was, I mean, and I am, trust me, the last person on earth who wanted to defend Beto O'Rourke. He drives me nuts. He's a Gen Xer like me. And it just drives me crazy that this is what our generation has produced in terms of political leadership. But the star chamber like atmosphere is accelerated because of social media. So he makes an off the cuff remark that, honestly, I think he was trying to compliment his wife, as you said, and kind of give props to her for doing so much of the domestic work. And that's great. That's actually, isn't that what the feminists have been telling men they have to do and should be doing, is, you know, feeling a little guilty that they're not pitching in as much around the house. So he gives her a shout out, and suddenly, you know, he's misogyny incarnate. He's, you know, patriarchal authority run amok. And this comes right after, of course, his video announcement where his wife sat next to him and beamed at him the whole entire time, but didn't speak. And this was obviously very disturbing to a lot of feminists who felt that she had, you know, somehow been silenced unfairly. It's ridiculous. I mean, this man and this woman should be able to come up with their own private domestic arrangements and work their marriage however it works for them. That's fine. He shouldn't have to grovel and apologize for that. And it doesn't speak well of him that he did. He should have said, you know what? That's how our marriage works. It works for us, you know, enough. But he didn't. He groveled.
Yeah,
right. The apologies, you know, if you want to apologize for something, and I have apologized for things before, you can't apologize with the expectation that people are going to be kind to you. You apologize because you think you should. Right. But when you don't think you should and you do anyway, what does that accomplish? Like, what have you done, really? I have zero belief that he was actually sorry. Mm-hmm. He was only apologizing in order to temper people. And so it just goes back to what I always say about how if we expect this kind of ideological or behavior perfection from politicians, we're really just electing liars, since no one is. So if you create that kind of dynamic for him where he now has to apologize for things he's not sorry for, he's just lying and about one of the worst things you can lie about, which is that you're sorry.
Well, that's such a good point. And I think it also is why we're seeing more of those I'm sorry to cite this song at all, but the sorry, not sorry apologies, right? The ones where people, where they claim they're sorry if your feelings were hurt. You know, I see more and more public figures going, well, if you were offended by this, I'm so sorry. That's the worst. That's just a slap in the face.
Oh, and they've even gone so far. Who was it recently who said, I unequivocally apologize, and then immediately equivocated?
Elon Omar.
Mm-hmm. That was just hilarious to me. It's like she didn't even know what the word equivocate means.
Well, she remember, we know from Nancy Pelosi that she has her own special understanding of words, so we have to be.
Oh, well, that's a good
point. So, and another area where this came through, and we saw this very recently with Tucker Carlson. The word that I hate, I can't stand this, is when, you know, they say, oh, these interviews resurfaced, you know, as if they were just kind of like out there and all
underwater,
of a sudden,
and they just floated.
Yeah, they just floated to the top and suddenly it was available for everyone to listen to. No, Media Matters went and had, you know, 25-year-old staff members sitting there listening to every interview on TV and radio this guy probably has ever done in the last 20 years to come up with these handful of objectionable things that he said. And Christine, I want to get your thought on this and just kind of frame it in the way that David French talked about it. He said people didn't really find this stuff offensive because they weren't offended before when he first said it 6 or 7 years ago. But this was a situation where people didn't want Tucker Carlson on the air, and yet this stuff was the fuel that they could use to start the fire, Tucker Carlson hashtag fire, you know, to kind of get the flames going on that. What do you think about that?
It was a really interesting back and forth that went on there. Look, I listened to a few snippets here and there of the stuff that Carlson had said on this radio show, and it's kind of gross in the way that, you know, I have teenage sons, so I sometimes overhear conversations I wish I hadn't heard. But, you know, it's juvenile, but it's also blowing off steam. So, you know, you go on talk radio to express your id if you're a public figure, right? So he gets to go express his id. People were not offended at the time, as you say. And I think the important thing, and this was the argument he made in his defense, was, you know, context matters. So if you're in the context of a sort of late night talk radio where anything goes, and you're doing that, that everyone who tunes in kind of knows the rules. But I think what we see being inflamed on social media is this absolute lack of context. So people take snippets of something someone said 20 years ago, slap it up there, and you know, the woke army descends and says, you know, this person has to go. So there's no context, there's no nuance. There's also no way for him to say, yeah, you know what, some of that stuff was pretty juvenile, but whatever, that was a while ago, it was talk radio, now I'm on TV, and, you know, I have different standards. He didn't make any defense except to say, so what, you know, come get me, which would not have been my advice to him. But let's recall that, you know, he has been harassed a lot. His family was physically threatened. People showed up at his home threatening him. So he comes to the table and comes to this debate with some personal experience that is relevant. So I admired him for not backing down, even as I didn't admire what he said so much in those interviews.
No, certainly not. I mean, and that's kind of that's the job, though, of quote unquote a shock jock. Howard Stern has been on the air now for what, nearly 40 years? Mm-hmm. Because he has the ability to kind of get people into a mood where they would say things that they normally might not say outside of that environment. Like you said, he wouldn't say that if he was on, like, you know, if he was on the radio with Charlie Rose or something. You know, they wouldn't even get into those kinds of conversations, I think. So one last thing. The idea that, you know, by criticizing the mob for coming after him is not the same as defending what he said. And that's normally, that's right, the kind of thing that comes out. It's like, well, wait a minute. I don't want the guy to get fired because of what he said. I didn't think anybody else should get fired for what they said. Even Joy Reid, because of her old blog post. Now, I said that she should have been fired for falsely bringing the FBI in by saying that her archives were hacked. But that was that's a much more egregious thing. And nobody was calling for her to be fired. So I don't like the idea of, if you like what you just said, there's some context, there's things, there's ways, you know, where he was discussing, all of a sudden it becomes a defense of the words that he spoke, which is not necessarily true. Ben, go ahead.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry.
I was just going to say, like, Howard Stern is our culture's, like, perverted Svengali. He gets people to say crazy stuff that, you know, now I wonder if, you know, down the line, fewer and fewer people are going to be more open with him because of this.
Well, I think that, you know, what bugs me most about the, I can't remember the word you, like, was it the woke brigades, I think you said?
Yeah.
You know, I think what bugs me the most about them is that it's all couched in this idea of virtue, you know. They're seeking to be virtuous and to demand virtue. But the way that they design it, they're not seeking something as virtuous as, like, let's say, redemption, because they put a person's livelihood at stake if they were to actually apologize. Like, let's say Tucker was genuinely sorry, or he genuinely regretted the things that he said. If he capitulates, he is in danger of losing his livelihood. So he has no motivation to actually do that. So these people are not seeking something virtuous, and they're pretending like they are. And I find that to be the most despicable kind of virtue signaling.
And
when you're doing something evil and pretending that you're doing it because you want the world to be better.
Well, it's very, I think it's why you often hear the word Victorian being used in the context of describing these mobs, because there's the hyper moralization, the language that's used, you know, it is a purity crusade. But the purity they seek isn't, you know, protecting women's virginity now like it used to be in the Victorian era. It's protecting, you know, pure thoughts that are considered correct, and having the right thoughts and the right behavior. It's a weird kind of behavioral monitoring that, you know, in fact, social media was designed to get people to do, because that redounds to the companies that sell that information to advertisers, of course, but we're also doing it to each other in a way that's kind of harmful to civility.
Well, it's weird, because, you know, when you think of the Victorian era, and you know, I think people would these days, you know, that the caricature would be the Victorians are, you know, today's conservatives are the Victorians of yesterday is the idea. You know, people protecting morality to a degree where they're really just being, you know, party poopers. But what's fascinating to me about the way the progressive left is working is that it's like they're doing the same thing, but to protect as much immorality as possible. We've seen the Berkeley parades where, like, grown men are walking around completely naked with kids nearby and things like that. That's what they want to protect. And they're doing that with the same, you know, aghast prudishness of the Victorian era. It's just like the most bizarre. You could write this. It's like the Capitol in the Hunger Games or something. It's just weird.
Well, and the thing is too, you see it from a cultural perspective in so many different areas. You know, let me just put it this way. So, Bill Burr, Christine, I don't know if you know who Bill Burr is. He's a stand-up comedian. And he appears on Conan all the time. And, you know, Conan is a guy who just sits there and says, you know what? What this guy just said is really funny. I just want to play a clip of something that Bill Burr said in a bit about, and he says this about women.
Women are so overrated, right? We went from we went from not listening to them to now it's ridiculous. Like that believe women. It's like all of them. How about 85%? I'll give you 87%, all right? But that last 13% that keys your car, lights your shit on fire, and puts a family pet in a pot of stew?
Who put a pet in a pot of stew?
Glenn Close.
Oh, that's close. Yeah. That's, yeah.
So the point that I was making here is that when he's on with Conan, it's such a relaxing atmosphere, because Conan, whatever, if it's funny, he's going to laugh. Now, and Andrea can back me up on this. Bill Burr was on Colbert, and it was a much different atmosphere. It was like almost like Colbert was like, oh my God, you know, he was turning towards, like, almost to where his back was to the audience, and he was looking at Burr like, you can't be saying that shit here, you know. And it was almost as if, you know, because, you know, Colbert is one of those late night hosts that is, it, you know, your word woke, he's in that category. And Burr is just sitting there. He's just saying stuff that he would normally say. And that's the, I mean, when it's applied to stand-up comedians, we've really reached a you know, critical mass in our culture where they have to watch out what they're saying.
Well, and that's the, I think, far more than, you know, accusations of bias on social media, even more than the you know, some of the complaints we've seen, particularly from political figures about, you know, are they biased against conservatives versus liberals, et cetera, et cetera. I think the greatest danger for everyone, regardless of political affiliation, is the desire to self-censor, because that's, of course, the dystopian nightmare, right? It's not, you don't actually need the state or regulators or censors or anything doing it, because you do it to yourself, because you fear the consequences if you don't. And I think, particularly in comedy, stand-up comedy, we see it a bit more and more creeping into, you know, television, to young adult fiction, for example. There have been a series of controversies in young adult fiction writing about that are fueled by this kind of identity politics and the backlash against authors who try to write anything other than their own identity, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, I think that self-censorship is far more alarming to me than even, you know, crazy Mark Zuckerberg trying to get into your living room with his weirdo devices so he can eavesdrop on what's going on in every American's home.
Well, what's interesting, too, is that, you know, it always depends on who it's directed at, right? Because while Colbert is giving him side eye for what he's saying, he had no problem calling Trump, what did he call Trump, Putin's cock holster or something like
exactly.
that.
Something
like,
yes.
You know, he had, and they all thought that was great. You know, they thought that was fantastic. Because so as long as you're directing it to the right people, I mean, if he had said that same bit, and all he had said was Republican women are so overrated, I don't think anybody would have, I don't think Colbert would, he would have been cracking up. He would have thought it was great.
Yeah, but I mean, again, that goes to the point, you know, it's like it's got to be a certain type of joke, whereas if you're Conan, you're going to laugh at it because it's funny. It's just and that's the way it is. And I think it was Jerry Seinfeld. Somebody asked him, are you ever going to apologize for anything that you've said, anything that you've bits or anything done? He goes, no, because it's a joke. It's not real. You know, it's I can't apologize for making jokes. You know, it's absurd.
The worst part about them going after comedians is so much of what drives the gotcha game on everywhere is, you know, there's no greater sin than the perception of hypocrisy. If somebody can make you a hypocrite, that's what they're going to go after you for. So like for Tucker, for instance, the idea was maybe the things he would have said, he said were fine if Howard Stern said them, because that's just who Howard Stern is, and he's not being a hypocrite. But because Tucker, you know, supports family values, then this is counter to his value system and it makes him a hypocrite, so then that's what they go after him for. And what's interesting to me is that this hypocrisy, or excuse me, these comedians, their whole thing is channeling without hypocrisy their deepest, darkest thoughts. They know that everybody else is thinking them too, and they're the ones who say it, and that's why we laugh.
And that's important. Yeah, that's, I mean, it's such an important escape valve culturally for us to have people who do that, right? We need that. That helps for healthy debate and just for sanity nowadays.
Absolutely.
But that, you know, you raise a really interesting point that I think is ultimately going to come back to haunt the kind of woke Twitter mobs. And that's when someone on supposedly their side goes off brand with their message. So I'm thinking here of Martina Navratilova lately, who's raised serious questions about whether transgender athletes should compete in women's sports. And, you know, she literally came from a point of, you know, wow, this seems wrong. And she got mobbed. So she said, okay, I'm going to study the issue. I'm going to go back, really look into it and inform myself, educate myself, which is what they were all telling her to do. She did that. She comes back out with a piece and says, yeah, no, it was worse than I thought. They really shouldn't be competing. It's unfair. And, you know, then it was just, you know, she's basically being called a transphobic monster. And it's a handful of radical activists pushing it back against her. But, you know, she lost a seat on a nonprofit board. She's probably lost sponsorships. I mean, this woman has been an LGBTQ activist longer than most of her critics have been alive. So it's sort of appalling. But there's an example where she didn't stay in her lane of wokeness, and now she's feeling their wrath.
Yeah, and that's,
you know, speaking of,
go ahead, Ben. No.
Well, speaking of how comedians say things that people, you know, think and don't say. Dave Chappelle, did you see his routine on Netflix? We was talking about transgenderism. And he was saying, what's that?
Yeah, yeah.
He was talking about transgenders, and he was saying, he wasn't saying anything negative in the sense of, you know, that they could be who they want and all of that stuff. But he said he gets a little offended when they start comparing their situations to, you know, Black Americans under Jim Crow and slavery and things like that. And he boiled it down this way, and the audience rolled over this. They laughed. He said, you know, it just, a lot of these are just white dudes it's just a bunch of white guys who've always gotten what they wanted, now acting like they're oppressed because we won't call them what they want us to.
Right.
And I was like, wow, he found a way to make a progressive way of looking at it that actually kind of works.
Well, yeah, but that is the division among, you know, the trans activists now have, I forget what the acronym is, but they have an acronym for radical feminists, because it is the more radical feminists on the left who are the ones saying, wait a minute, we fought, we had court cases and legal battles, we did all of this to give girls a chance to compete in sports and to have more opportunities to play sports. And now a bunch of dudes are coming in and saying, actually, right, no, I feel like a lady and I want to run in the 200 meter. And they win. And this isn't just a matter of, I mean, it was interesting. I was looking into it a little bit. I wanted to answer some questions I had about the issue myself. And I thought, wow, this is about a lot more than just a principle, because there's money at stake, right? A lot of these kids are trying to qualify for college scholarships. They're trying to get sponsorships later on, maybe go on to Olympic competition. So it is their life path that's being, you know, stepped on by men who have decided that they're women. And it raises a huge number of questions, not just legally, but culturally and socially, that we aren't only just beginning to try to answer.
Yeah, and speaking of Chappelle, you know, he actually, we talk about the Twitter mob. He caught a ton of grief for that stand-up special because of some of the jokes that he made. You know, he talked about Caitlyn Jenner and said, talked about how, you know, this is a decision they should make for themselves, and this is fine, and I'm happy with it, you know, and it's good for America. And he goes, that's Dave Chappelle, the American. He goes, although Dave Chappelle, the Black American, he was a little jealous. I was like, how the F are transgender people beating Black people in the discrimination Olympics? You know, it was funny. Yeah. But people on Twitter were freaking out. I mean, I'm reading a tweet here where he's like, I'm me watching these Dave Chappelle specials while he spews homophobic, transphobic, misogynistic BS. And it's kind of like, but again, he's making jokes. He's making light of real situation, but using jokes. I'm not sure. It's obvious what he actually means.
There really is some privilege, if you'll forgive me, built into this idea, which is I'm triggered by that word.
I'm sorry. It's a microaggression.
For instance, you know, somebody at a young age starts taking these hormone suppressors. They start
puberty
doing
blockers,
and then,
yeah,
right, and so this puts them at a disadvantage in boy sports, but it doesn't necessarily diminish their advantage in girl sports. And the idea is that because this person has chosen to do this thing that they are fully aware is going to create that dynamic, we all have to accommodate them to make sure that they can play a sport. Why do we have to do that? I started smoking when I was 16, and prior to that age, I had run cross country track. I'm not sure that my decision to start smoking, which decreased my lung capacity and screwed with my endurance, meant that everyone around me now had to accommodate my smoking habit by changing the rules of cross country track so that I could take a break every 5 minutes.
Yeah, and there's the scientific evidence on all of this is really fascinating, because the trans activists say, oh, well, if you just, you know, as long as they take male suppressing hormones and start taking female hormones, they're just like women. They're just a little taller. But in fact, it's so much more than that, especially for speed based sports and strength based sports like weightlifting or, you know, sprinting. I mean, it's the muscle mass, it's lung capacity, it's bone density. These are things that actually aren't, you can't turn the clock back and make men people born male weak as females are. And, you know, the most fascinating figure is that the fastest boys in high school right now can beat most Olympic level female athletes in the same sport,
right.
You know, so that they're just, boys are different physiologically than girls. And we know this, which is why we've accommodated athletic competitions by dividing them. And I think, I mean, look, I would be fine if there was a trans athlete category and they all competed against each other, like go for it. But right. they shouldn't be stopping
or to
girls.
They could even create something where, you know, like a third category where other people could also choose to compete, even if they were of another gender,
right.
You know. So if a girl was like, no, I want to compete with this, you know, then they can.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea that we're no longer going to recognize facts about physiology is not transphobic. It's not transphobic to think that. Like, any person on the left who listens to this podcast is going to say, listen to this if you want to hear three or four, excuse me, I didn't mean to exclude you, Andrea. I know Jay always does that. Four conservatives, you know, having the most disgusting transphobic conversation ever. I haven't said anything about their life decisions. They can do whatever they want. It's just a question of whether or not we're going to recognize that that's what's happened. And the talking point from the left, which I am not convinced that all the left has bought into, is that they aren't a new category of woman. If they decide to become a woman, they're literally a woman. And so all of the rights and all of the physiological assumptions are going to be built into them as though they were born a woman. And it's just the most anti-scientific thing I can think of. They're not.
Right. And it's anti-woman. If you're a woman and you hear that, you go, no. Hold up there.
Yeah. And well, right. And here's the thing, too, is like when you see these, you know, when you see, you know, trans people, you know, in high school sports, particularly where they're engaging in, you know, they're performing in girls sports. You're going to have young women who are going to, like, you know, lose out on scholarships and things of that
yes.
nature because they're no longer going to have those gold medals and those first place wins and things of that nature. There's always a consequence that's going to come down the road, and that never happens because in the name of, you know, diversity, in the name of, you know, not being a bigot and being, you know, everybody kind of, you know, everybody singing kumbaya, you know, you do these things and you're not supposed to just sit there and accept it, but you're supposed to cheer it on. You're supposed to be happy, and if you're not, then there's something wrong with you.
What really annoyed me was I read an article where it was one of the high schools where there were two trans boys that were winning in the track meets.
In Connecticut,
and,
yes. Mm-hmm.
And there was a girl that they brought into it, and she was like, I don't see the problem. We should just be able to compete. But that girl placed high enough that she's going to go to the same meets they are. Like, she came in third or fourth or something like that. And, you know, so when you go to these larger track meets and there's college scouts there and things like that, she's still going to get seen and they're going to be judging her based on her. And they're going to be aware that there's these two boys. And so when they see these two trans boys, and so when they see that she's in third place, they're going to know that doesn't speak to her. We're judging her on her. What you have to think about is the person who didn't make the cut, you know, because they're going to be 20 people compete and only 10 make it to the next thing. So that 11th girl didn't get through. And now she doesn't get in front of these people at the scouts and the college scouts at the track meet.
Well, and if you're a college women's track coach whose livelihood and job depends on winning, you would make the completely rational choice to recruit trans athletes to the women's squad that you coach because they're going to beat everybody else.
Exactly.
They're half a second faster than the closest woman behind them, which is a huge amount of time in a sprint. I mean, there's just no comparison. So, of course,
not to mention the woke marketing you get for your university.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, look at how open we are. Yeah. So I think this is just the beginning. And in 10 years, I'll be really curious to see what high school girls athletics look like. And I think that was where Martina Navratilova was saying it might not exist as we know it anymore unless we start talking about this honestly.
Exactly.
There's no way, though. It's like I said this forever ago when people were freaking out because somebody said SpongeBob was gay and everybody was, you know, who cares and all this stuff. And I remember saying at the time, I was just like, you know, everybody's saying who cares because they know the show is not going to suddenly have an episode where Squidward and SpongeBob are making out. And all of these people who are swearing that it's like totally, I have no problem with it. The moment that show came on and Squidward and SpongeBob start making out, they'd be like, this is ridiculous. And they get upset because when it comes home, it's different.
Well, look, every Harry Potter character is evidently gay now, right? Or like into bondage or something. Like every few weeks, J.K. Rowling tells us something we didn't need to know about the kinky sex lives of the Harry Potter characters.
I seriously sided with a lot of the progressives who went after her because there was one guy who tweeted that he was like, he was doing like a fake conversation tweet. He was like, J.K. Rowling, no, Dumbledore was gay. And he's like, oh, is it in the story? No. It's not in the story or the movies or any of the canon. But I promise he is because they had hot sex. It's like you've literally done nothing. Like you've done nothing.
All right. So we're going to move on at this point because we've been
talking about. We're going to end with Dumbledore having hot sex.
Okay, well, that's it. We got to do the news.
That's a solid transition.
Yes.
Right there. Oh, man.
So it is time for Andrea to do the news. All right, Andrea, what do we have?
All right. Well, Jay, I know this is near and dear to your heart because you wrote about it for the Washington Examiner this week. But the helicopter parenting has now turned into what is called snowplow parenting. Helicopter parenting, the practice of hovering over anxiously near one's children, monitoring every activity, is so 20th century. Some affluent mothers and fathers now are more like snowplows, machines chugging ahead, clearing any obstacles in their child's path to success so they don't have to encounter failure, frustration, or lost opportunities. Taken to its criminal extreme, that means bribing SAT proctors and paying off college coaches to get children into elite colleges and then going to great lengths to make sure they never face the humiliation of knowing how they got there. One came home because there was a rat in the dorm room. Some didn't like their roommates. Others said it was too much work and they had never learned independent study skills. One didn't like to eat food with sauce. Her whole life, her parents had helped her avoid sauce, calling friends before going to their houses for dinner. At college, she didn't know how to cope with the care with the cafeteria options covered in sauce.
There it is. Sauce. Causing people to quit college, you know, they can't take it.
Yeah, the whole thing runs counter in my experience. I have four kids and, you know, I've got friends in the neighborhood and I see the helicopter parenting. And what's interesting is I've always thought of a lot of the helicopter parenting and a lot of the soft ways that people try to prevent children from feeling consequences or feeling failure. It's like a form of procrastination because they all know what's right. But in that moment, these parents are thinking more about themselves. It's not that they don't want the kid to feel bad. They don't want to feel bad. And so since they don't want to feel bad, they try to protect the child from the consequences and they tell themselves, yeah, I probably need to get better about that. But this one time, I'm going to go ahead and buy the toy so he'll shut his face and stop crying. And it's about themselves. It's about their need to feel better, not their child's.
Well, it's a funny contrast too, right? Because just a few years ago, weren't we all supposed to be inculcating grit in our children? It was all about grit and resilience and grit. And now suddenly, you know, I guess it's about grit unless you're, you know, the child of a celebrity and an Instagram influencer. And then, you know, then it's just about how many followers you have, I suppose. But that actually the celebrity and wealth aspect of this that intrigued me the most was the weird sort of insecurity those parents must have because they understand, look, these kids are already privileged and wealthy and well on their way. They really don't even need to go to college. But there was enough kind of intellectual insecurity among that parent class that they knew that their kid would be taken more seriously and hence they would be taken more seriously if, you know, Junior goes to USC or Georgetown or wherever they were buying their way in. So that was kind of interesting to me.
Right. But it gets worse because even if they went to Georgetown or USC or in this case, Stanford, because this was in this New York Times piece I read and I absolutely was it was one of those jaw dropping moments. So they flounder, said Julie Lithcott-Hame. She's the former dean of freshmen at Stanford and the author of a book called How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. Listen to this. At Stanford, she said, she saw students rely on their parents to set up. It's hard for me to not laugh when I'm reading this. Rely on their parents to set up play dates with people in their dorm.
Jeez, oh my God.
I was like, these are adults. Stanford is one of the premier universities in the United States. I mean, it's like the founders of Google went to Stanford, and we've had Supreme Court justices that went to Stanford, and you have to have mommy set up a play date for you? And as an 18-year-old?
You know, the way you get over social anxiety is by being in situations where you have to get over it so that you can stop being alone in your dorm all the time playing video games. Like, I didn't start caring about paying bills till I actually had some. Nobody had to hand them to me. I created them myself. These people have to learn by doing. They can't be handed it. And all the kids in my neighborhood, I mean, I live in a beautiful, wonderful cul-de-sac, and these other parents, but yeah, that's them someday. The people you just described, that's them setting up play dates for their college kid.
Well, and to go back to what Christine was saying, you know, Lori Loughlin and Massimo Giannulli, at least they're the parents of the two main people that we hear about, which is Olivia Jade, who is an Instagram influencer. She was a beauty, you know, kind of maven. But they've actually affected her actual like income in life. She had a actual business of being a beauty. You know, she had a contract with Sephora. They've canceled her contract with them. And so with her. And so it's very much affecting her life. She never needed a college degree. She could have gone the Kardashian way. The only Kardashian to graduate from college is the boy, Rob. I mean, she could have gone that way. She never needed it. They were like Mike Rowe said, they were buying a credential. That's it.
But this is best for her. Let's be honest. She was making, she was making a living.
She was going to cure cancer. Darn it. She was
in a lot of ways, I think she will look back and think if this might've been a good moment in her life, because she was making a living off of filtering photos on Instagram. You know, I just think that she might find some more substance out of life at this point. So this could be good for her. I don't feel bad for her. Let's just say that.
Yeah, no, I mean, other than the embarrassment factor. Yeah. So the next
Hold on. I was going to say one last thing here. And it also comes back to, I think, you know, this is a little bit dangerous, but parents, you know, we do this. And so there's interactions that you might have had. And those of us, you know, millennials are like that. I just want to listen to this very quickly. This is Dana Carvey at the age of 60. It's his special on Netflix where he's talking about...
God, he's 60?
Millennials.
Millennials are just so fast with their fingers, and they can Call of Duty and Skype and text. But you're completely crippled when it comes to basic things because your parents are always right there, and they're the experts. A typical millennial kid will go, Mom, we don't have any heat in our apartment. And the mom goes, well, you should probably call your landlord. Millennial kid, I'm not real good at calling landlords. Could you do it?
Mm-hmm. It's perfect. Sorry, go ahead, Andrew. You can go on to the next story now, but I had to play that because it's just like so perfect.
Yeah, you've lived that. Yeah. No, so the next thing is for, you know, as we know, there are dog lovers on this podcast. So
known as correct people.
Yes, well, I don't hate dogs. I just like cats, too. But there's a new, and Jay, this might interest you, being someone who lived in Florida for almost a decade and a half. There's a new bill coming up in Florida that would make it a first-degree misdemeanor to leave your dog restrained outside and unattended during a man-made or natural disaster. So that includes when people will tie up their dogs and then leave because they've been evacuated for a hurricane. So this is new. It's coming up in the legislative session. So it means that leaving your dog roped to a tree at your home while you evacuate, as many did during Hurricane Irma in September of 2017, would be considered animal cruelty. As a first degree misdemeanor, punishment could include a year in prison, according to Florida state statutes, or up to a $5,000 fine, or both. So.
I- So can I just weigh in because I'm a Florida native?
And absolutely.
The only reason Twitter is useful is for the Florida Man Twitter account. If you don't, you know.
Oh, yeah.
If you know about Florida Man, you know what I'm talking about. But I feel like that, did they specify, we all know what a natural disaster is, but in Florida, I think you actually have to specify man-made disaster because so many, I mean, this is a state that has alligator wrestling. I mean, what qualifies as a man-made disaster?
Reuters bill defines man-made as a situation in which someone has received notice from a local or government authority that an event attributed in part or entirely to a human event, error, or negligence, or involving the failure of a man-made system is either happening or will happen.
Like a dam breaks. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Okay.
Okay. So yeah, if somebody sets a fire, I mean, I was in Florida '98 when they had the fires and the town that I lived in, the entire town got evacuated. I can't imagine people leaving their pets tied up and you know, because I mean, there literally were houses that just burned down. My brother-in-law's house nearly burned down, former brother-in-law. And we went back to his house and there were like dead squirrels like on the edge of his property that got like roasted. And I just can't imagine people leaving a pet, a dog or something like that behind. I mean, I understand you got to take stuff, but it's like, you know, I'm more, that's why I kind of like, you know, the movies, you know, where like the pets always seem to make it out of these things. It could be like a Category 5 hurricane that is, and they always go back to the house and the dog, whoop, whoop, you hear him come running out. He just comes out of the bushes or something, you know.
I'd like to expand the law to make it so that the jerks in the neighborhood behind me can't leave their dog roped up outside while they go to work all day. That's and then terrible. Leave this stupid thing barking all day. Of course he's going to bark all day. It got so bad. I was on the Nextdoor app, which is like Twitter's basement.
Yes.
And there were people complaining and all of us about the same dog, which you could hear, for a mile around. And I went outside and I just hear a guy every time the dog barks screaming at the top of his lungs, "Shut that dog up!" And I got back on the Nextdoor app and I was just like, all right, now we have a barking dog and a yelling man. Can somebody please control this situation?
But I'm all for legislation that helps dogs. You know, they can make it easier. It's like if they can make it legal, say it's like illegal to feed your cat to an alligator in the case of a natural disaster, a man-made disaster.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's obvious, right? I mean, yeah. You got to protect yourself. So you toss the cat as you're running from the gator.
You just have to run in a zigzag because alligators can outrun you in a straight line, but they don't turn very well. If you grew up in Florida, you know this. This is like you. And also lots of dogs do get snatched by gators.
They do.
I was born. Yeah. I didn't really grow up there, but I was born there in Florida.
It's
pokey.
That explains a lot, Ben.
Yeah.
So my last and final thing that we can wrap up with is that, you know, we've seen a lot of, you know, glowing profiles of Beto O'Rourke and some other, and of course, you know, the non-glowing profiles, which is the, you know, hosing, at least ostensibly of, Klobuchar. But the person that seems to be on the radar for VP pick already, who's getting, you know, profiles in New York Magazine, et cetera, is Stacey Abrams, who still will not say that she legitimately lost the Georgia governor's race. Hickenlooper has already gone to meet with her. And she's, like I said, she's got a glowing profile in the New York Magazine this week. And it is just the same kind of thing that you would see. I mean, Tom Steyer is kind of like, you know, looking at her for, I mean, he's running a, you know, not even a campaign. He's just out there throwing money at whatever, you know, it'll stick to. But yeah, so as far as, you know, the whole Georgia governor's race, that she is already coming out as this person that everybody's kind of flocking to as their possible VP pick.
Loving the idea of Beto and Abrams like the ticket of election losers.
Election, you know, and just so this, there was a great tweet that Evan Smith, who's the CEO of the Texas Tribune, and Texas Tribune is not by any stretch of the imagination a conservative organization. They're a good news organization, but you know, I would say that they probably tilt left. even he, back, this is last August, this is 2018, he's like, even he was like ridiculous. He tweeted out, he goes, the humping of Beto O'Rourke's leg by every magazine in America is, well, something. I mean, he knew. And it's like, he understood. It was like, I was living in Texas at the time, and it was just ridiculous. The Town and Country does a profile on him, you know.
Yeah.
And well, I was watching, and we were
like,
oh, no, I was going to say, laughing today, because Chris Eliza was doing this thing about which candidates and what grades they get. And he comes to Beto O'Rourke, and he goes, I'm giving him an A because, you know, there's a lot of people out there that say he's like a dark horse candidate. I don't really think he's a dark horse candidate. I'm thinking, who in the hell has said he's a dark horse candidate?
No one.
Well, and the Stacey Abrams thing, I agree, Andrew, is really odd because it's not just that. Sorry, that is my dog barking in the background.
Yeah.
It's not just
fire
that she,
up.
It's not just that she didn't concede the race, but she spent a good part of the time while she was running and since basically arguing that our system is terrible, that democracy doesn't work because she lost. Mm-hmm. And
right.
I feel like she's an extremely charming personality when she's interviewed, and I've heard her talk on the radio. She recently did NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She was great. So people are like, oh, she's so charming. She's so approachable. But if you actually listen to what she said when she was running for governor, it's an extremely negative message. It's a very, it's not, you know, America's the city on the hill. I mean, it's really, really negative. It portrays us as having a corrupt voting system. She could have misconstrued or deliberately misled voters about how, you know, voting laws had been changed in the state of Georgia. And the fact that she wouldn't concede really still bugs me. It just really bugs me.
Yeah, it was terrible. The Georgia voter ID law, which is a pretty strong law, no doubt, but it's very easy to get a free ID that a state does not charge you. They're like, you just go here, get an ID. Record minority turnout in 2008, record minority turnout in 2012, and there was record turnout again in the governor's race. This idea that somehow or another, Brian Lamb managed to somehow game the system so that he could just enough votes that he could keep people from getting to the polls is very targeted. Yeah, it's something. It's one of those things that goes into the ranks of conspiracy theories.
Like,
but
yeah,
yet they were giving it.
If he could get it that targeted, he needs to start a business right now.
or it's the soft bigotry of low expectations that people can't get themselves free ID.
But back to, you know, to what you were saying about that it's a VP hunt. First of all, Hickenlooper, I've got so much experience with that guy because of a lot of work I did in Colorado, and he is a bumbling idiot. I just can't imagine that there's a way I can't even express. There have been so many videos where people are like, he's either really dumb or really drunk, and we can't figure out which one it is. So I don't feel like he's going to go very far. But the conversations about who's going to, you know, who BP buzz, I find so useless right now, because it's going to be a demographic choice, and it's going to depend on who the nominee for the Democrats is.
Absolutely.
So if it's a female nominee, then it'll probably be, you know, kind of wide open in terms of who the VP could be, but probably male. And if it's a male, especially if it's a white male candidate like Biden or something, there's just no doubt that it's going to be a female VP. There's no way that they're going to have two men on their ticket. That's just not going to happen. So until the 2020, you know, until the primaries play out a little more, it's just all noise to me about who the VP would be.
Oh, meanwhile, you've got Cory Booker teasing a White House wedding with Rosario Dawson, that's desperation, folks.
Big time.
It sounds so much. And I'm sorry, I know that this is like horrible, but doesn't it just sound so much like, no, my girlfriend in Canada, we're thinking about getting married. Like, that's just what it sounds like.
Yeah. She's out of town.
It does. Oh man! All right. Well,
who proposes that way? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Talk privately first.
Don't.
She was probably. She would probably just like, wait, what? What did he say?
All right. That's gonna do it for news. That's gonna do it for this episode of the Fifth Estate. Christine Rosen, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you had a good time.
I did. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, and you'll be back, I hope, at some point.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Perfect. You can find me on Twitter where.
I was going to say.
Florida Man. I'm at Florida Man.
Oh, that's it. There we know. Now we know. No, but you make sure you go over to commentarymagazine.com. You can read Christine's stuff there. And, of course, in the print magazine. Always fun to read. Ben, where can everybody find you?
You can finally find me giving into my worst instincts as a human on Twitter at Ben Howe. You can read me sometimes in some places like the Daily Beast. And I have a book coming out in August called The Immoral Majority.
Awesome. Andrew, where can everybody find you?
Well, like you, you can find me decreasingly on Twitter, but also you can subscribe to the ARC Digital newsletter. I curate and edit that. So,
all right. And you can find me on Twitter less and less these days, but you can find me there at Jay Caruso. And also go to my profile on Twitter. You can sign up for my newsletter called The Monday Notice. I send it out just once a week. No spam, none of that stuff. And it's just more kind of like random thoughts and any kind of major thing. And it's, I have fun doing it. So. All right. So, everybody, thank you for Christine Rosen, Ben Howe, and Andrew Ruheim, Jay Caruso. And we'll see you next time on the Fifth Estate.